This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's turn first to our Reporters Roundtable section of the program. And we'll start out first with Dan Carden, who is with the Times of Northwest Indiana. Covers not only the State House, certainly when the legislature is in session, but he's also covering Lake County government news as well, too. Dan, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Happy to be here.
I know you had two stories out here, starting out this past week with the story that, and they're both about the same guy, Michael B. Brown, who, yeah. If that name is not familiar to anybody, he is the Lake County recorder, who seems to have disappeared. Well, not disappeared from the face of the earth, but certainly disappeared from the government center, to be sure. And the first story that you had talks about the fact that he did come to show up before the county council. And then the second story that you had out there just recently was more dealing with money. And we've had some information in the newscast about the fact that at the time, the county council was going to make some changes when the 2020 budget to account for Mr. Brown's not appearing at work. But first, if you will, I'll let you set the stage into which you want to cover, since you did both of them, as to Michael B. Brown and why he's not showing up for work, and maybe what kind of impact, if any, it's had on the Lake County Recorder's Office.
Yeah, so Michael Brown's in his second term as the Lake County Recorder. His term runs through 2020, he's a Democratic office holder. In 2017, he was the subject of a sexual harassment complaint by a subordinate in his office that ultimately got settled by the county for $185,000. When Mike Brown, and since that time, Mike Brown has seldom shown up for work. We now know, after he was subpoenaed by the Lake County Council to explain why, he says that the incident made him feel uncomfortable at work, uncomfortable around his subordinates, and he didn't want to potentially trigger anything else along those same lines. So he claimed to be working from home. Other people in his office who testified to the county council said they haven't seen him for a few years. There's been, by all accounts, no diminishment of the work of the recorder's office. Yeah. They seem to have gotten along pretty well without him. Members of the Lake County Council, you know, based on complaints that they've been hearing from constituents and residents of Lake County, and even just, you know, anybody looking at the situation would say, hey, this guy's still getting paid for coming to work, for not coming to work for a couple of years. And anybody else who had a job who didn't show up for a couple of years probably would not still have that job. Things are different when you're an elected official. He's responsible to his constituents. He can't be fired by the county council or anything like that, as it will. But what the county council did a couple months ago, when they were getting pretty frustrated with him, was for the 2020 budget, they put his salary in at $1,
yeah,
trying to encourage him to be, you know, maybe come to work. And that did seem to have an effect, because he did respond to the subpoena after previously stonewalling the county council. And he has, according to Councilman Vandernulk, been showing up for work more often. And so the council earlier this week put his salary back at about $65,000, at that amount for next year, with the provision that if he stops showing up for work, they will encourage the county prosecutor to pursue what's tantamount to an impeachment process.
Yeah.
But incredibly complicated.
Yeah, I get the impression that at least that's, he may not be fired, you know, because he was elected to office. But yeah, they could impeach him just as it higher up the food chain can happen. So
they can. Yeah, it's kind of complicated. The prosecutor has to go to a grand jury and, in effect, indict him for not performing his duty, and then there has to be a jury trial where Mike Brown can make the case for why he hasn't been showing up for work or why he shouldn't be removed from office. So it's a lot. It's like an impeachment, but it's not, let's say, as easy as a federal impeachment would be, and that's not easy at all.
Now, in the process that you of the county council making of discussing and then making the decision originally to give only a $1 salary for 2020 for Mr. Brown, did they have any discussion about this? I'm sure that they heard all this information from the members of the recorder's office staff about the fact that he wasn't at work. Not only after, I guess, the incident with the former employee and the charges of harassment and all against him, but apparently must have been some other issues in the past if it had been a couple years that he had not shown up to work all the time.
Yeah, and when Mike Brown testified, he said it went back to that 2017 incident and that he didn't feel comfortable going to work. Mm-hmm. He said that following the incident, he developed mental health issues and anxiety, and there were days where he wanted to come to work and would think he was going to work and then just couldn't bring himself to do it. He seems to... nobody subpoenaed his medical records, and he wasn't under oath when he was speaking to the council, so there is some question about the validity of those claims, but whatever he needed to do, he seems to have done, because now he, according to several people in the recorder's office, is coming to work.
I know that you put in your story, the latest story, I should say, to be clear, that obviously the Republicans here in Lake County they're not necessarily, I suppose, having a field day using this example as to how things should be better run in county government, but they certainly didn't like the fact that Mr. Brown was not showing up and was going to be getting his full salary. And they, I know one council member, I'm sure that, you know, was probably pushing pretty hard for at least not letting him have the 3% pay raise.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty bipartisan, let's say, disappointment with him or anger with him, depending on how you want to look at it. But State Representative Lake County Councilman Charlie Brown, former state representative, who's not related to the recorder, seems to be probably the most miffed. He believes that, you know, as we were saying before, that if you're not coming to work, you shouldn't get paid. And Charlie Brown was the only councilman to vote against restoring Mike Brown's salary. There was some reluctance by some of the other members, but basically the council's attorney told him that if he is going to come to work, he is entitled to get paid, and you can't just, you know, stick him with a dollar for an entire year's worth of work. So ultimately they came around, but Charlie Brown wanted to make the point that he still feels that it was wrong and that Mike Brown shouldn't be getting paid.
I guess the question then comes up as to whether Mr. Brown has gotten the message that he should do everything he possibly can to be sure to show up, at least talk with the council members about all of this if they felt that they need to have some consultation rather than just not show up for work.
Right, and that was actually a key point that some of the council members made when he appeared before the council, that if he had come earlier and told them that he was having mental health issues or anxiety, mm-hmm. being treated for it, relating to his earlier incident, I think a lot of them would have been much more sympathetic. But to just not show up and, you know, leave the entire office in the hands of his deputies, who have been, you know, more than capable, but, you know, he is the elected official and it's his responsibility and duty to do the job that the people of Lake County elected him to do.
Well, I guess now this has all led to the possibility that that the chief deputy in the recorder's office has been at least, I'm sure, maybe encouraged by some, but certainly strengthened by the fact of all of this happening, that that she's decided that I'm sure that she's going to run for election next year.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard an announcement from her, but several people on the council suggested, including Republicans, suggested mm-hmm. that she might want to do that since she's basically been doing the job for, you know, an entire term already.
Yeah, interesting to see what will come about out of all of this as well. One of the other stories that you covered as well, a couple of stories actually, one of the two stories that have come out lately here that have been in print and online on the latest election scene has been looking ahead to 2020 and I guess the possibility that we're going to have another race for a state House seat. Tell us about what House Lager is interested in doing and maybe if you've had any opportunity to talk to Chris Chung about this too.
Yeah, I talked to both of them. House District 15, which covers Dyer, Shererville, St. John, and Griffith, had been represented for the past few years by Hale Slager, the Republican. He was defeated in 2018 by Chris Chung, a Democrat from Dyer, who ran, you know, by all accounts, even Hale Slager's accounts, an amazing campaign, going door-to-door, really building support for his candidacy and winning the district. So that seat's now a Democratic seat. Hale Slager wants to go back to the legislature. So it looks like those voters in that district are going to see a rematch on their ballot in 2020. If nobody else gets into the race, Hale Slager says he realizes he ran a poor campaign in 2018 and that he still has a lot of work that he still wants to get done at the State House. So he's going to challenge Chris Chung. And Chris Chung sort of said, bring it on, that, you know, he knows how to run a successful campaign. He won an election against Hale Slager already, and he's prepared to do the work both in the district and at the State House to convince people to vote for him again. So it should be an interesting race in an already interesting election year.
What are some of the things that Mr. Slager mentioned to you when you talked with him about his decision to put his name back up or try for an election again in next year, as to what he would try and do that he couldn't maybe accomplish during this term of office that he had had before?
Yeah, it's interesting. Some of the stuff he wanted to do did get picked up this past legislative session by other region lawmakers. Mm-hmm. So one of the things Slager was trying to do was solve this problem with Indiana Medicaid payments to out-of-state children's hospitals. Right now, Indiana Medicaid pays less to, say, a children's hospital in Chicago that treats an Indiana child than it would pay to Riley Hospital for Children in Indianapolis. Chicago hospitals aren't especially happy about that. They're not at the point where they're turning away Indiana children yet, but there may come a day where they do. So former Representative Slager was trying to find a way to equalize those payments, because if, you know, these Northwest Indiana kids ended up coming to Riley, Indiana would be paying the full price anyway. So why not pay that same amount to a Chicago hospital and let especially Northwest Indiana kids and families, you know, go to a hospital that's closer to home? You know, often these families have other kids who, you know, need to be in school, and the parents want to be at the hospital, and they need to be able to coordinate all that. And it's a lot easier to go 45 minutes into Chicago than 3 hours to Indianapolis.
Yeah, I know that was one of the things that you mentioned in your story in particular, and he's mentioned as well to us here in previous conversations here on Lakeshore Public Radio. So, yeah, he's very, very, very concerned about that, and that should be something done. It could be done. It's just a matter of working out the bureaucracy, it sounds like, too. What are some of the other things? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, he also wants to look at financially distressed local governments. It was a big thing a few years ago when the General Assembly took over, passed a law to authorize the state to take over the Gary Community School Corporation after it had racked up $110 million worth of debt. What Slager wants to do is put a more prospective process in place for similar situations. The Gary School thing was kind of a one-off ad hoc thing that they were kind of making up on the fly as they were going through the session. He wants to have a law in place so all communities would know what kind of help was available from the state and what would be expected from them in order to get it if they are facing financial distress.
Okay. Now, briefly, was there anything out of the ordinary that Chris Chung mentioned to you when you talked with him?
No. You know, he seems ready to compete against Slager, and the voters there should be set up for an interesting fight. One of the interesting things about Slager is he was the last, and Julie Althoff, who also lost in 2018, they were the only Republicans elected from Lake County, who lived in Lake County, represented the county. The Indiana House is a very Republican chamber, and a lot of the policies that eventually get passed by the House are decided in private meetings of House Republicans. So right now, and I'm not saying this to disparage the Democrats who replaced them, right now there's nobody from Lake County in that room where the decisions are made, and that can present some challenges, especially in a budget year. One of the things Representative Slager was able to get done when he was in the House was get funding for a bunch of Northwest Indiana projects, including the South Shore Line, the Bioscience Building at Purdue Northwest, and currently there's nobody in that committee from Lake County who is in the majority.
Oh, good point, Smith.
Yeah.
We got a couple minutes left here. Dan, let's talk about the other story that you had briefly. And I mainly wanted to get not so much the facts of the story, that is the fact that Eddie Melton is running for governor on the Democratic Party ticket in the primary next year, but it's kind of the reaction and the atmosphere in the room there at the Gary Public Library when he made that announcement this week.
Yeah, I mean, it was extremely positive. I mean, obviously, there are his supporters who are coming out to cheer on his announcement, but... I think he did an interesting sort of a hometown type of announcement. If you recall, Governor Holcomb did this big to-do at the gym where they filmed the movie Hoosiers 30 years ago and, you know, did this whole basketball-themed thing. Eddie Melton's theme was, you know, I'm from this community. I have made a difference here. I want to make a difference across the state. He had several teachers, people he's mentored, who spoke about what Eddie Melton has meant to them in their lives and what he has done for them and for all of Gary. And, you know, he wants to take that same message of, you know, listening to the people in Indiana and implementing the policies that they need as opposed to maybe what big business wants, and taking that to the State House and being elected governor.
Well, Dan, it looks like there'll certainly be more stories to come from Eddie Melton on the campaign trail as it comes up here, and you get to overlap those two, I'm sure, for a while when the General Assembly comes back in session back in January. Thanks for spending some time to cover all these with us today here on Regionally Speaking.
Anytime.
We'll talk to you again soon. That's Dan Carden with the Times of Northwest Indiana, who covers not only statewide politics, including the legislative session, too, but also politics and government here in Lake County. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's check in with Olivia Hirsink. She's the morning police and the breaking news reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. She's with us on the program today. Olivia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
One of the stories that you have out there in print and online talks about Erica Rios. She's more than just a police officer for the city of Griffith. Tell us about the specialty that she has and how important she is to the police department.
So Erica is a social worker, and so she allows the police department to kind of look at criminal activity from a new angle in terms of looking at the issues that may be causing someone to actually engage in illegal activity, such as, you know, whether they be in a domestic violence situation or there's drug abuse or something going on that just is kind of prompting them to, you know, to be on the police radar. Okay. And so she's able to kind of be more of a proactive role instead of a reactive role, and so looking to prevent crime before it actually happens.
I know that you start your story out with a sentence that reads, Erica Rios understands the importance of support in a time of crisis. And there was a reason why you put that in your story. Tell us a bit more about Erica and why she has been able to show her personal feelings and put them to work on a professional level.
So initially, she's a native to the region, but in 2003, she was living in California, and she was married, and both her and her husband are from Griffith, and he was serving in Iraq and actually died 2 months into his service, and she had just said that she was consumed just, and I wrote this too, that she was consumed with this feeling of just having nowhere to go, no one to turn to, and of no one really knowing what to do and how to help. And so it really prompted her to look within and want to be that person for other people that she didn't necessarily have at that moment.
I know that it mentioned in the story that she had done some work for the DCS, I guess, out in California, and then she came back to Northwest Indiana and decided to take advantage of, I guess, what experiences she had out there after her husband passed, and to be able to put it to work here for folks in Northwest Indiana.
Yes, and so I actually believe she did work with DCS over here, too, and so that really helped her to get contacts. And so when she is dealing, when police are dealing with kind of a maybe a child abuse situation, she knows kind of exactly who to call and knows the process and is able to actually, you know, help people work through those steps if they're, you know, coming up into a situation where a child might be taken from a home or there's questions.
Mm-hmm. I know that you mentioned in the story about the fact that Erica, basically, she took the initiative and approached Griffiths Police Chief Greg Mance. And what did Chief Mance tell you about his conversations with her and what led her, led him, I guess, I should say, to be involved in the in hiring her and putting her on the force to be able to do her work?
Well, when she approached him in 2016, he was super open to it. And he actually had an officer who was looking to kind of expand the role that social services plays within their specific department. And so that officer was working out of a grant that he helped find, and it was running low, and he knew that they needed a more permanent situation because what the officer's work had just shown the demand for that in this area. And so I think it was a quote, too, he said that, he doesn't even know if it was like divine intervention or just plain good luck. But when that grant was about to run out and he was, you know, wanting to look for something permanent, that's when Erica approached him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was, again, just super receptive. And she came on first as an intern while she finished her last year of graduate school and then was hired full time in January 2018.
I understand the Griffith Police Department is pretty unique among other police departments in Indiana in having somebody on this type of role.
Yes, they found out that she is one of two full-time social workers actually operating out of a police department. And she's also the only one that they were able to find because she works part-time within Griffith Public Schools that has kind of that foothold in both the schools and the police force, as well as having that social services background.
I know you mentioned in your story about the fact that it's not only unique to have somebody on full-time, but actually to have somebody on a police department doing this type of work, that it's not typically, I guess, what you consider a realm of a social worker.
No, and that's one of the things that they've noticed and has really helped them become more effective is because traditionally, you know, they operate kind of in what they call these different silos. And so one would refer to the other, but now they're able to just have that one person they know where to go to at their disposal. And she's able to kind of immediately help people rather than, you know, waiting for them to get called back from a referral.
I understand, too, that she's working with the Griffith school system to help, I guess, in some way as well, too. Is there, I guess, a bridge between the schools and the police department in the work that she does and she can help do?
Yes. And so what's been really neat that she talked about, too, is looking at cycles. And, you know, she's able to see kind of if between two systems of looking at. So if the family's dynamic is being affected by crime or things like that, or again, those issues that cause people to engage in illegal activity, you know, oftentimes that's going to seep down to the child. She's able to kind of look at that perspective from the child side and kind of help them out because, you know, if things are, you know, a problem at home, then oftentimes things are going to be a problem at school. And so she's able to help kind of put an end to things there and be preventative at a younger level.
I know she's pretty busy, of course, right now with basically two jobs, working for the Griffith Police Department and helping at the Griffith school system. What's in her future? Does she have plans?
I think that her biggest mission right now is to really just continue to, one, improve Griffith, but to show other departments the benefits of having a social worker full-time on staff.
That's great. That's a great story. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was a really neat story, and I really enjoyed writing it.
Now, the other story that you've got out there in print and online, we have to mention while we have you, is to talk about the sad case of somebody who probably didn't get his bagel for breakfast, or he had to go to another store to find it. They lost an entire semi-load of frozen bagels. Tell us about that. It's just a police story, but it's a very unique police story.
Well, it was over in Jasper County, and a man was driving a semi that was carrying 38,000 pounds of bagels, frozen bagels. And a cop had noticed that there was smoke coming from the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And so he stops him, and as soon as he gets out, you know, to look at what's going on, it goes up in flames. And all of those bagels are now strewn across the roadway because the driver actually disabled the actual truck from the trailer and then was able to kind of see the wreckage. And, yeah, those bagels were toast.
Oh, yeah. Well, now they're part of the local landfill there in Jasper County, I suppose, get all that cleanup done to be sure. So that's the way it happens sometimes. It kind of goes into the category of frozen bagels on the road and burned up. In this case here, it goes in the category of a semi-load of chocolate syrup or something like that that has to be cleaned mm-hmm. up as well, too, to be sure. So, well, Olivia, thank you for spending time to talk about the stories that you have out there in print and online. And we hope to have you back again on Regionally Speaking again soon.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed speaking with you.
Olivia Hirsink is the morning police and also the breaking news reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Most people can't recall a time when there wasn't a bridge over the Indiana Harbor and Ship Canal near the steel mill in East Chicago until it had to be demolished. But now a big new bridge is going up in its place, and it'll be open to traffic before you know it. In fact, 2020 is the projected completion and opening date. I had a chance to talk with Terry Velikan, who's the general manager of operations with United Bridge Partners, and with Laura Weber, who's the office manager at the facility there in East Chicago and the communications specialist, about this Klein Avenue Bridge project, this new toll bridge that is being built, replacing the one that was torn down because of structural issues. And the plans calling for the traffic to be able to move again early next year. We had a chance to do the conversation in the conference room in the project office building that, when the work is finished, will become the operations office. It's nestled just to the other side of the big casting building that you'll hear Terry talk about, and beneath the piers and the bridge deck that is about 100 feet above it. Here's the conversation.
United Bridge Partners, who Laura and I work for, acquired this bridge from NDOT. And the total length of the bridge is about 9,000 feet long. The new bridge itself is 6,235 feet, and we're rehabbing the steel bridge, which is about 2,700 feet long. I came to United Bridge Partners about a year and a half ago. I grew up in this area. Most of my family were from here. My grandparents lived in East Chicago. We were all born at St. Catharines. So I have a local knowledge of what this bridge means to Lake County and East Chicago. So it's nice for me to be on this project and see, after 10 years of being decommissioned out of service, to actually be a positive impact for Lake County.
If you will take some time, tell us about a little of the history of the Klein Avenue Bridge itself. People that have lived here all their lives or they're relatively stable people that have lived for a number of years are familiar with the bridge. It's had before we start our conversation, we know it's had a rather checkered past, and that was back at the time when the bridge that is now no longer here is being replaced by the new one.
Right.
Was still up or was being built at the time. It was not even up yet at the time. Is that, I suppose, where the history of the bridge, it's the old bridge, kind of begins?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think back in the 1970s, 72, something like that, the Klein Avenue Bridge was initially built. And in 1982, they had that tragic accident that it collapsed. Since then, NDOT rebuilt it, and they rebuilt it in 19, took about 4 years to rebuild. And then in 2008, 2009, they deemed it structurally deficient, and then they took it down. But going back in history, there's a lot of people, obviously in 1970s up until 1982, that relied on this bridge. Industry was booming. Amoco at the time, which is now British Petroleum, ArcelorMittal, which used to be U.S. Steel, Youngstown, they were all booming. So I remember back as a kid picking my grandfather up on Dickey Road, and there was probably 300 or 400 people walking down Dickey Road for shift change. So at the time in 2009, 33,000 cars drove Klein Avenue Extension every day. That just shows the impact of what the bridge has on economy and commerce.
And we know that when the bridge had to close, when the NDOT had deemed it as being structurally unsound and they ordered it closed, that caused a lot of problems, even sure. The time before the old bridge came down was demolished.
Yes. So, and that's interesting because a lot of people don't realize what that bridge meant. So not only to commerce and economy, but now you have the Borman, which has approximately 880,000 vehicles on it every day, came up Klein Avenue, all those vehicles and trucks, heavy haul trucks, commuters to Chicago. When the state closed the bridge and deemed it deficient and said, well, we can't build it anymore or it's not viable, that a lot of that traffic went onto city streets, whether it be Gary, East Chicago, Hammond, and even Whiting. So what happened is the cities, Hammond, East Chicago, and Gary, didn't have the money set aside to repair all their city streets. So a lot of that traffic impeded not only commerce, economy, but also commute times as well. And then it was a negative influence on the economy of each city because those city streets didn't handle all that traffic or weren't supposed to handle all that traffic. Not only the city streets, but what about the infrastructure? You know, the 33,000 cars in 2008, 2009, where are they going to go? They're going to divert off into the city streets. So it's huge. I mean, you know, part of the benefit for this bridge itself in talking about that is, you know, not only the money that was now set aside for rebuilding your streets, but what about the communities? You know, safety was a concern. If you, you know, had a street that only had, say, 50, 60 cars on it, now you have 100 to 200 cars on it every day. Kids running down the sidewalk, people biking. There's no, safety measures put in place for that heavy traffic. Mm-hmm. Emissions. The emissions, obviously, this is a highly industrial area, but even with that overflow of traffic, you create more emissions. So this bridge benefits that by having the flow of traffic, and it'll cut down on emissions as well.
The old bridge is down. It's gone. Yep. It's nothing there any longer.
Right.
And that's when the United Bridge Partners came in and started getting set up. Explain first about the work on the building, because it's probably one of the more difficult things to kind of fathom. But you have mm-hmm. to have some place, if you have all these segments that you're making,
yes.
you have to have some place to make them.
Correct. That's a good point. The casting building currently is 24,600 square feet. And we put that in as a means and methods in terms of the project to cast these segments. Each segment weighs anywhere from 85 to 100 tons. The benefit of putting that casting building on our site, it reduced transportation costs, it reduced labor costs, it reduced cost of stopping and starting if we would make them outside. It enhanced our quality because we could be in a controlled environment and we could cast throughout all four seasons.
Mm-hmm. How many other bridges the United Bridge Partners is doing or has been doing in mm-hmm. the past that have this similar sort of setup where you have a building that actually creates the segments that will in turn become the finished bridge?
Currently, United Bridge Partners has two bridges underway, one in Chesapeake, Virginia, which is called South Norfolk Jordan Bridge. We've had that for 7 years now. The second project is Klein Avenue Bridge. We also have a joint venture partnership with Hubel Road Extension in Joliet, Illinois. And then we just signed an agreement with Bay City, Michigan. So we'll have, in the next 2 years, we'll have four projects. Getting back to the casting building, because that's interesting, on Jordan, we didn't have a casting building. So it's kind of lessons learned in a sense, and it's kind of innovative. Twofold. One, we actually have the land here that we could put the casting building so close. And two, we knew that this area, being so close to Chicago and Lake Michigan, going through the rough winters, we had to do something to keep the project on track. So that's why it's kind of lessons learned and say we have the ability and we just built it into our construction model.
You mentioned the segments, that they weigh about 100 tons each
mm-hmm.
when they get put into place here. how many segments will we finally have when it's all complete? And I guess maybe in a way too, how do you be able to take it from all these segments from the ground? Basically, at one point you have to start out from the ground level,
yes,
and work your way up to the bridge to its highest point so that it covers the canal,
right,
and then comes back down again to connect up with the highway system on the other side of the bridge.
Right. So once a segment is cast in the casting building, we currently have three what we call casting beds in the casting building, and we could make a segment one every 2 days. So essentially, we wanted to make approximately 50 to 100 segments before we even started erecting them. Because once the erection gets started, they do about 5 segments a day. So we wanted to make sure that we have a backlog of segments that we wouldn't run out of segments when we're erecting.
Pretty fast work when you think about it, having to put it, you know, you can put up 5 segments a day, so mm-hmm. that does carry the project along pretty quickly, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And that's one of the benefits of kind of lessons learned on our South Norfolk Jordan Bridge,
right,
is we wanted to be able to make this whole project more efficient. And as we move into other projects, we're going to take those lessons learned and make the process even more efficient. So I think a lot of people in this area will understand that a bit in terms of that casting building is actually a manufacturing plant to make big segments, kind of like Lego blocks. And that helps out the project tremendously.
Now, let me ask, once all the segments are made, which you see you're getting pretty close to right now,
mm-hmm.
and the real work of putting the bridge together finishes up, what happens to the casting building?
Well, the casting building has to remain with all the casting beds in place until we'll actually erected everything,
mm-hmm.
685 segments. And the reason we do that, we have to make sure that's in operation, because if one segment is damaged a little bit, we'd have to recast that. So we don't want to essentially dismantle the casting building,
right,
completely until we're all done with the project. Once the project is complete, then we'll decide what to do with the casting building. It's a great area in north part of East Chicago to either have trucking, manufacturing, somebody said another ice skating rink, a hockey rink. The ability to do something with that remains as a good opportunity for East Chicago, and we have approximately 37 acres here that we could develop.
Now, Laura, if you will, talk a little bit about the marketing aspect here. As Terry and the crews have done the construction work to actually build the segments to get the bridge actually in place and up visible to anybody that comes by, what do you get to do as the marketing guru, so to speak, on the local scene to let people know more about the importance of the bridge, but about the benefits that the bridge is going to bring when it's all completed?
Thank you for asking. So, as the communication specialist for Klein Avenue Bridge, we want to promote the benefits of the bridge. So it serves as the most direct route into Lake County and the most time-saving route to Chicago. And as Terry mentioned, it does reduce congestion. And as he also mentioned, the free-flowing traffic, not sitting stuck in traffic, helps reduce pollution from idling vehicles and from people unnecessarily sitting around. So we want people to know what the benefits are. So in terms of tolling, I wanted to speak to that. It's easy for people to use because it's all electronic tolling. They can pay with a transponder, which the most common around here are the EasyPass or iPass, or if they don't have one of those, then they can pay by plate. So we have the rates up here too. So for a two-axle vehicle with an EasyPass or other transponder, the current rate is $225. So for vehicles with three or more axles, it's $494. And then there's a separate rate for people who pay by plate.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the big question is, why is marketing so critical for a bridge? And Terry's run into this himself. I think his niece has asked, like, why do you have to market a bridge? People are going to use it no matter what. Which isn't necessarily the case, and I like to stress that the bridge, since it's a toll bridge, is a product in some ways no different from an iPhone. If you never advertised the iPhone, you wouldn't understand the benefits, you wouldn't understand how it fits in your life. So it's just a product, but on a very different, very large scale. So the previous Klein Avenue Bridge, as we mentioned, was demolished 10 years ago. So those who used to travel that route found alternate ways and don't take it anymore. So they've pretty much, I know they haven't erased that route from their brain because we hear frequently from people how much they miss it. So they found alternate routes, and people who've started driving within the past 10 years need to be introduced to it from scratch. So we have people from both ends of that spectrum. So what our marketing goals are, to drive awareness right now, to let people know, I feel like we need to do a campaign like, yes, it's coming back.
Probably not a bad idea, because right. Like you say, there have been enough people that have not been driving on the bridge since the bridge was demolished. And if they, as you say, if they've taken the alternative routes, whether it's through town or other ways, even far around, as far south as the Bourbon Expressway, to get around all the area, and they want to get them back on, and the only way to do it is to let them know that it's up there, you can see it, and pretty soon you'll be able to drive on it.
Right, exactly. So that's where my role comes in. So right now we're building awareness, and with that, some anticipation. And once the bridge is open, we want to drive usage and engagement for people to continue to see the benefits and to continually know why it saves them time and saves them hassle and just makes their life easier and simple, hassle-free when they can get from point A to point B without hesitation and getting so.
Chris, one of the things, if I may jump in here,
sure.
Too, you mentioned, and I just want to kind of bring it up, is, you know, this bridge was up and running in 2008, 2009. And at that time, I mentioned there was 33,000 cars on the bridge. Most of those, I say cars, most of those vehicles supported the industry around here. So BP, ArcelorMittal, U.S. Steel. Well, in those 10 years, a lot of individuals that used that bridge either aged out in terms of employment, either retired or moved away. The workforce diminished. So what Laura was saying is, you know, it's kind of like we have to re-educate a lot of people that, hey, some of the people that use this and say, oh, I remember that bridge, they're not in the workforce anymore. So there's a new workforce that not only is bypassing the mills, they might live in Lake County, but still work in Chicago and vice versa. A lot of people that work in Chicago have homes on the lake that during the summer or whatever, they take this route to get to their homes there as well.
And so the new Klein Avenue Bridge will be a benefit to them, to be sure, at their way to going, say, from Chicago to the other side of Lake Michigan over into Michigan proper and every place in between, wouldn't it?
Most definitely, yes. Yes, definitely. So it has a wide-ranging impact, not just for this area, but for... We call it the gateway of Lake County for a reason, because it helps people get around and through to major areas. Northwest Indiana's major area, all the vacation attractions along Lake Michigan, and of course Chicago. So this is a vital corridor that we're helping people navigate more easily.
As we kind of wrap up the conversation, are you, Terry, finding more people that are getting to you when you talk with them about the bridge, since it's getting so close to being completed and the route opened up again? Are they anxious to be able to drive on it again? And we're not talking necessarily business and industry, but just the average public that would come through and, as you say, use the bridge on their way to where it may be.
There's a lot of anticipation, and for the events that we go to, and we have our public outreach events, wherever I go, because I'm newer with the company, I hear that demand loud and clear. People are just telling us, like, when is that bridge going to be finished? We can't wait for it to be back.
Well.
So there's a lot of anticipation for it, which reinforces just how important this project is.
Okay. Can you bring us up to date here on the timetable? When, if things go well and no big problems happen, that the bridge will be up and running for vehicles?
So we're excited for a 2020 opening. We'll keep you posted with updates, but we're looking at next year. So it'll be here before you know it.
That is Laura Weber, who's the office manager, and she's also in charge of marketing with the United Bridge Partners here on the Klein Avenue Bridge project, along with Terry Velligan, who's the general manager of operations on the project with United Bridge Partners. And we spoke in their project office building, which is virtually underneath the just to be soon to be completed Klein Avenue Bridge. a Northwest Indiana organization that is fighting for what is called triple negative breast cancer research is holding its annual conference and a gala event this month, and in fact this weekend. And the proceeds from the 9th annual LFC Pink Tie Affair, which is coming up October 12th at Ameristar Casino in East Chicago, will support local triple negative breast cancer research along with breast awareness programs and early detection measures. LFC board member and Pink Tie Affair committee member Karen Morris and Dr. Mary Nicholson, the regional director for breast imaging services for community healthcare system, were on Regionally Speaking to talk about the organization and about the research that is underway into the disease.
Laini Fluellen was a really dynamic young woman. She was an athlete, an educator, and a mentor who had a real gift for connecting with young people. She was especially drawn to young girls that needed spiritual, social, and emotional guidance, and she was hands-on in her mentoring. She attended their sporting events. She provided tutoring. She really was about instilling excellence and exposing young women to what's possible for their lives. Unfortunately, at the age of 35, Laini was diagnosed with a very aggressive form of breast cancer called triple-negative breast cancer, or TNBC. It's a super aggressive tumor that disproportionately affects young women. There are very few treatment options, and that results, of course, in lower survival rates, only 77% compared to 93% for other forms of breast cancer. But despite her poor prognosis, Laini survived 3 years beyond her late-stage diagnosis, and she really used her time to educate others about TNBC through TV and radio and print media. So Laini Fluellen Charities, which is what we're talking about today, and their signature event, the Pink Tie Affair, is a local all-volunteer organization that was founded in 2009, and it really embodies Laini's commitment to education and service by raising funds and investing in programs to educate and support breast cancer awareness, mm-hmm. advocacy, and treatment in our communities.
Okay. Dr. Nicholson, I'd like to know a little bit more here about this particular ailment. It's probably not very well known. If you will tell us a little bit more about triple negative breast cancer and what seems to make it so different as opposed to other types of breast cancer.
Triple negative breast cancer really is one of the 8 to 10 different subtypes of breast cancer that we do know exist. It is not very common. It's been reported, though, to affect about 15% of all the women afflicted each year in the U.S. with breast cancer. And among those women with it, they tend to be younger, meaning certainly less than 50 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
And this subtype in particular seems to affect women who are premenopausal, African American women. And the type of breast cancer presents at a higher grade, meaning at a more aggressive or assertive level of activity, and it tends to be the kind of breast cancer that will occur in between a mammogram. So it's what we call an interval breast cancer.
Does this also affect Hispanic women as well?
Yes, it affects women of all ethnicities.
Yeah.
Trying to answer the very good question about trying to find out who are target populations that are maybe at more risk than other women, it would probably be, as already primarily noted, the African-American women, but yes, then Hispanic women and Caucasian women in that order. Mm-hmm. But really no one is protected based on ethnicity. One more other caveat about its aggressiveness and its seriousness is that unlike other forms of breast cancer that may not have this same title of triple negative, but for example, triple positive is another subset, there is not a relationship with triple negative breast cancer between the size of the disease when it comes to our attention, and then the extent or the presence of disease outside of the breast. So that means metastatic disease outside of the breast, is more common with triple negative breast cancer than going exactly 180 degrees opposite triple positive breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
if always and only breast cancer limited itself or contained itself to the breast as we recognize the breast, then really people would not lose their lives. Sadly, it's when there's metastatic disease, when other organs such as liver, bones, brain, lungs become involved, that sadly we really are not able to, of course, achieve a cure. Remission is harder also to achieve, and sadly people will lose their lives to the disease.
Well, I suppose that makes it the reason that the cancer is so bad. It's such a rogue disease, and it does whatever it is tending to do. It's not the way that you'd like for it to be, and I'm sure that even the treatment has got to be the same way as well. Now, I know that you've been very much involved directly in making an impact on breast health here in Northwest Indiana. Would you talk a little bit about your involvement in the research and how some of this work has turned out?
My subspecialty is within the discipline of radiology, and I'm a fellowship-trained breast radiologist, as we're blessed to have several of us now in the region with that kind of subspecialty training. And our focus is really certainly on encouraging women to help themselves as best they can and attain the screening tools, meaning participate, say, in mammography, clinical breast exam, health maintenance with a healthcare provider annually, because our strongest weapon against TNBC or any breast cancer is early detection. And I have the great privilege to work with some of the colleagues in this area who are actually doing research with and participating in the therapeutic administration of medicines such as immunotherapy.
More information about the October 12th gala can be found on the Pink Tie Affairs page on Facebook. That's it for Regionally Speaking. Our thanks to Dan Carden and to Olivia Hearsink with the Times of Northwest Indiana, and to Dee Dotson for work on the production of our program this week, and to you, the listener, for joining us. We'll be back with you on Monday.